There are three basic ways humanity's economic relationship to the environment can work. We can overshoot the physical limitations of the environment and destroy it. We can overshoot the physical limitations of the environment, feel the effects, overreact, undershoot the limitations of the environment, feel the effects, overreact, overshoot the limitations of the environment again, and so on, always fluctuating around the limitations of the environment, but never being in control of the situation, never knowing what to expect, and always causing avoidable problems through our ignorance. The other possibility is we recognize problems arising and react to them in advance, before the problems get out of hand. The commercial fishing industry is an example of an overshoot of a physical limitation of the environment, leading to the collapse of an environmental system. Fishing hooks were invented about 60,000 years ago. For 60,000 years, fish were income for some people, and they were free food for materially poor people who lived in coastal areas. Now we have oceans full of fishing trawlers dragging 50-kilometer-long fishing nets just to catch smaller numbers of smaller fish every year. Now we have fish farms where we invest a lot of resources into trying to do things the oceans used to do for us for free and not being able to do it nearly as well. Now materially poor people who live in coastal areas can't catch their own fish and can't afford to buy them either. I grew up on the East Coast and so did my mother. We've seen this happen almost firsthand. The fishermen where I come from would go out to fish on George's Bank, off the coast of Canada. The problem was, nobody knew how many fish there were in the ocean. All anyone knew was that there had always been lots of fish in the ocean, so nobody imagined how it could be possible to catch them all. Most deep water fishing takes place in international waters. That means there was no regulations on who or how many people could fish where or when. Basically, no one thought the situation through far enough to see there could be a problem, no one paid attention, and no one did anything about it until the problem was already upon them. The most materially wealthy people built the biggest ships with the biggest nets. They caught so many fish that materially poor people couldn't catch fish anymore. They basically stole the food off the materially poor people's tables and then sold it back to them. What did you expect? What they did was legal, and they made profits from it. Big surprise. Now people are trying to solve the problem by limiting the numbers of people who are allowed to fish, decommissioning fishing boats and things like that. If all goes well, the world's fishing banks will recover within a few hundred years from now. This is a perfect example of environmental destruction being caused by faulty social structures. Now we're trying to solve the problem after the fact, and we're trying to solve the problem by adapting the very social structures that caused it in the first place. The world's oil supply since the OPEC embargo of 1973 is an example of a fluctuation around an environmental limitation that causes endless problems. A lot of people love to say, "Don't worry, just trust the markets. The marketplace will work everything out." The world's oil supply is a perfect example of why that isn't true. By 1972, Americans and other people had built their economies on the assumption that a certain amount of oil would be available. But then the people who controlled the flow of oil decided to cut back on the supply. They imposed an artificial environmental limitation by not pumping it out of the ground as quickly. When the oil supply stopped meeting the demand and drove gas prices up, there were two basic solutions people found to the problem: improve fuel efficiency or find more oil. Some people did one, some did the other. Since everyone was acting independently in the marketplace without any sort of oversight or control, no one had any way of knowing what everyone else was doing. It takes time to develop new cars, and it takes time to drill new oil wells. If 1,000 people each react individually to a change in the market as of 1973, but nobody's solution will go into effect until 1975, there's no way to predict what will happen by the time everyone is done. People overinvested in solving the problem. By the time everyone's fuel-efficient cars were built, there was so much more oil in the market that the prices had dropped to the point that nobody saw any point in buying fuel-efficient cars. Since there wasn't any money to be made in fuel-efficient cars, people stopped building them and stopped investing in fuel efficiency research. Then there was another oil embargo in 1979. All those delays built into the marketplace solution made everything fluctuate again. When the physical limitations of the world's oil supply finally caught up to us in 2000, we could have had a 27-year head start at developing fuel-efficient technologies to deal with it, but instead we'd thrown it away. Both of these overshoots happen for the same reason any overshoot happens. Basically, economic momentum has outrun people's environmental foresight. People kept investing more and more money and resources into their economies, planning on there being enough resources left for their investments to pay off, but they were wrong. For example, people kept building bigger fishing boats to catch more fish because that had always worked before. But when the fish started to run out, a lot of people had brand new giant fishing boats. Now that they'd gone to all the trouble of building their fishing boats, they had to catch some fish with them to pay for their new giant fishing boats. So now that the fish were running out, they kept on catching fish anyway and making the problem worse. If they had been paying attention and realized ahead of time that they were starting to run out of fish, they could have stopped buying big new boats and could have stopped catching as many fish. But they didn't think of that. Once again, they were being humanocentric, assuming that just because what they were doing felt right to them proved it must be a good idea, and didn't realize that their own actions were causing the problems. Avoiding an overshoot depends on people being able to see that they're approaching a physical limitation and being able to take action to correct it before they pass the limitation. In the same way, if you're walking at night, you have to walk slowly enough that when you see something on the ground in front of you, you'll have time to stop before you trip over it. Humanity's economic relationship to the environment is no different, just a lot more complicated. The chlorofluorocarbons and the ozone depletion was an example of people anticipating that they were reaching an environmental limitation and taking action to correct it before they overshot the limitation. Chlorofluorocarbons were first invented in 1928. They were used as coolants for refrigerators and air conditioners, as aerosol propellants in packing material and insulation, and in electronics components. It wasn't until 1974 that scientists discovered that one CFC molecule would start a chemical reaction that would destroy millions of ozone molecules. They started testing the ozone layer. They discovered that the ozone layer was being destroyed everywhere, and especially over the poles where the CFCs were building up because of the air currents. Ozone is an unusual oxygen molecule. An ordinary oxygen molecule is made of two oxygen atoms stuck together. An ozone molecule is made up of three oxygen molecules stuck together. You may have noticed that thunderstorms make the air smell strange. That's ozone you smell, which is created when lightning adds a lot of energy to the air. Ozone also forms high in the atmosphere because the sunlight has a lot of energy when it first hits the atmosphere. Some of that sunlight never reaches the ground because it hits dust in the atmosphere. That's enough energy to create ozone. The sunlight contains a lot of different kinds of energy. If you have ever known anyone who has broken a bone and gone to a hospital to get an X-ray, you have an idea what I'm talking about. An X-ray machine works by shining what are called X-rays through the person's arm or leg or wherever, and then taking a picture of their bones. An X-ray is basically a special kind of light that we can't see and that can shine right through a person. The X-ray machine works because the X-rays stop when they hit the person's bones. The X-rays that don't hit any bones hit some special paper on the other side of the person that's sensitive to X-rays. The X-ray photograph is a silhouette of the person's bones so they can see if the person has a broken bone. There are X-rays and other kinds of light that are similar to X-rays in sunlight. The problem is they can cause cancer. Luckily, the ozone molecules high in the atmosphere stop them so they don't reach the Earth and hit us. The problem with CFCs making the ozone layer deteriorate was that now some of the dangerous light could reach the Earth and hit people, animals, and plants. That would be bad news for everyone, and especially for farmers. There were a lot more delays in solving this problem. First, there was the time it took for CFCs to be created and put into refrigerators or wherever, and then for them to leak out and escape into the atmosphere. Then there was the time it took for the CFCs to reach all the way up to the upper atmosphere. Then there was the time it took to notice the problem, study it, and discover that it was affecting the atmosphere. The ozone depletion the scientists discovered in the 1970s was caused by the CFC industry of the 1950s or something like that. All the while, people were manufacturing more and more CFCs and installing them into more and more things they were going to leak out of eventually and escape into the atmosphere. Then there was another delay caused by the time it took scientists to discover enough evidence for people to act upon. Then there were more delays caused by the time it took for people to start acting. Then more delays caused by business leaders dragging their feet as usual at recognizing there was enough evidence to prove there was a problem. Then more delays caused by some political leaders dragging their feet and saying it wasn't a problem. In 1987, 13 years after the problem was first noticed, the first international meeting was held at the United Nations for politicians to try to figure out what to do about the problem. Then more delays were caused by politicians disagreeing about what they should do about it because of the effects that banning CFCs would have on their different economies. But they did at least sign an agreement to get the process started. Over the next 10 years, more evidence came in that showed that the original agreement wasn't enough to solve the problem because the problem was worse than anyone had realized at the time. So 4 more meetings were held and more agreements were made until by 1997 an agreement was finally made that could contain the problem, at least as far as we know, with the phasing out of CFCs and other ozone-destroying chemicals in 2000. This is an example of a problem that was solved before it got out of control, and with all those delays, it still took 26 years to solve the problem. The ozone layer is still being destroyed, and will continue being destroyed for maybe 20 more years. Ozone molecules are produced by chemical reactions in the atmosphere, so once all the CFCs break down, the ozone layer will recover, but once again, it will take hundreds of years. Environmental sustainability depends on a certain combination of environmental and social structures. The basic economic structures we need are to constantly monitor our impact on the environment, to take action when warning signs are first noticed, to adapt our economy as necessary to solve the problem, to adapt our economy even more if necessary when further information comes in, to keep our economy moving slowly enough that its economic momentum won't outrun our environmental foresight, to use renewable resources only as fast as they're renewed, to use non-renewable resources only as fast as alternatives can be found to replace them, and to pollute only as fast as the natural cycles of the world can break down the pollution and reclaim it. Of course, doing all of this will require us to construct political systems that make doing these things possible. That means radical social change. Radical social change means revolution, because anytime anyone tries to make radical social changes, many powerful people try very hard to stop them. But you're already having a revolution anyway. Now all that's left for you to do is to win and solve the problems you're rebelling against.